He has entertained audiences of theater, television, and film for decades. Now Nathan Lane will be live on stage at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady on Friday night for an evening of conversation and Q&A following a showing of one of his most hilarious films, The Birdcage.
What is this dream I see? Why does it seem so real to me? What if this dream turns out to be more than a dream? Fairy dust, fairy dust, fairy dust. Come, little dream, and play. Don't be afraid, don't fade away. Quick, little dream, before you're gone. Let's get it on. I saw that. Well, this is impossible. Either I'm an artist or I'm just some cheap drag queen playing it straight so he can get laughs.
Let's just try and get through it.
Well, you always ask so much of me. I have to understand every nuance of a song. I have to give a full-out performance, but everyone else can just get through it. I mean, he's chewing gum.
Chewing gum helps me think.
Sweetie, you're wasting your gum.
Let's take it from the bridge and no more talking from anyone.
You can hear behind-the-scenes stories from his life and career, which has earned him Tony Awards, Emmy Awards, and a Screen Actors Guild Award, as well as numerous other accolades and nominations. His big screen roles include The Lion King and Ironweed. He's one of our greatest stage actors. He has starred in everything from Mel Brooks's The Producers to Guys and Dolls to most recently The Front Page. Beginning in February, he'll reprise his West End role as Roy Cohn in Tony Kushner's Angels in America at the Neil Simon Theater on Broadway. It is a great pleasure to welcome Nathan Lane to the Roundtable. Nathan, thank you very much for being with us. What a delight.
Oh, thank you, Joe. Lovely to be here.
Realizing that you have done this already of going out and talking about the film, showing the film, hearing people laugh at it, and then talking about it, what has that experience been like for you so far?
It's been a lot of fun. The audiences have been wonderful, and they're in a very good mood after seeing the film, and they're obviously happy to see me, and it's been a joyous thing. It was suggested to me, and I thought it would be a fun thing to do. And we've just done two of them, but they were great successes, and I'm sure it will be the same in Schenectady. I've really had a blast. It turns out I'm good at this, and there are many stories. I have many stories to tell. So it's been a great deal of fun, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I'm assuming that if anyone had told you that 21 years later you would be sitting on a stage talking about a film that you were making at that point, you wouldn't believe them. But at what point did you start to realize that the film was everlasting, that it still made an impact in people's lives?
Well, look, it's a story that has always been successful. It's, you know, that started, you know, in Paris. Jean Poiré, who was comedy partners with an actor by the name of Michel Serrault, and they used to appear in sketches on French television, wrote this play for the two of them to do, and it was a huge success, the play, La Cage aux Folles. And then they made this film, the French film, sort of a French-Italian production. So Jean Poiré steps aside, and an Italian actor, Ugo Tognazzi. I don't want to throw names around, but Ugo Tognazzi was hilarious. And Michel Serrault recreated his stage role in the French film, which at the time was the most successful foreign film ever made, and I ran for like 2 years on the Upper East Side in New York. I had just moved to New York in the late 70s, and I had seen it and loved it. And then, of course, there was the Jerry Herman musical version on Broadway.
Right.
But before that, Mike Nichols had attempted to do it as a stage musical with Maury Yeston writing the score, and it was called The Queen of Basin Street. It was set in New Orleans. But that never came to fruition. Alan Carr was going to produce it, and it didn't work out. But finally, he reunited with his partner, Elaine May. She had helped him on movie scripts through the years, but they had always wanted to do this, and they finally got the right. So it's a story that's been around a long time. So I'm not surprised. It's one of the great comic plots. I'm not surprised that it has survived many interpretations. And look, it goes back to you can't take it with you. You know, the eccentric family meets the conservative family. But it's, it's ultimately, and, you know, in its way, in the late 70s, it was incredibly subversive because in the form of a French farce, they were promoting really gay marriage, a long-term gay relationship that's very successful. They're very successful at the business they run. They're respected in their community, and they've lovingly raised a child who wants to get married. And, and it was incredibly funny as well. And I think that's what survives is that, obviously, it is the gay-themed film, but and certainly the Birdcage, in America, that's the most successful mainstream film about a gay-themed film that's been made so far. And I think it just struck a chord with people. It's interesting that now, people still bring it up, and many of them are not aware that there was a French film that it's based on anything, or they somehow think it's somehow based on the musical that Jerry Herman did with Harvey Fierstein. But it's a story that I think everyone can relate to, and it's ultimately about love and family and just being who you are.
You were talking about the 70s, and certainly true, but even in 96, when this film was released, the majority of states in this country had bans on gay marriage written into their constitutions. So even then, sure, it was making a difference, really, in understanding that it was about, as you say, something that everyone could relate to.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Mike Nichols wanted to, it's very well-crafted, and it's sort of, even those conservative types, it brings everybody in, and it's sort of, it's a little, I will say, it's still as effective. It's a little tamer than the French version. I mean, they allow, they make it a, he's a conservative, and in some ways they make my character a conservative as well, was interested in family values. It's hard to dislike that particular character. I can't think of a day that's gone by where someone hasn't brought it up to me and said, how much they loved it or what it's meant something to them. Either young gay people who said it had a great effect on them when they were struggling with coming out, or just people who have said it's something I've watched with my family. It allows people to come together in a way that they maybe ordinarily wouldn't through laughter. It's always easier, I think, to make your points through comedy. Yeah, no, it was even a risk in the 90s. It's scary to think about that, but it was, yeah. But I think it certainly, they were, Mike and Elaine were aware of that and sort of shaped it around certain things that it would be, it's hard to take offense with.
There is so much to talk about when it comes to this film because of its pedigree and who is attached to it. But Mike Nichols and Elaine May, perhaps one of the greatest comedy duos of all time.
Yes, that's a fact. I wholeheartedly agree. They were certainly. I was a huge fan of theirs, and so to get to work with them and Robin Williams was a dream. So they were heroes, and they all lived up to what you would imagine they were like and more. Elaine is still with us, but yes. Certainly Robin and Mike and Robin especially was incredibly generous and kind to me, and just he was such a wonderful, sensitive soul, and just a great deal of fun to work with and collaborate with.
Of course, you can pass as an uncle. You're a great performer. I'm a great director. Together, we can do almost anything.
Oh, Amon, really?
Absolutely.
Oh.
We've got 5 hours. All right, first, get your pinky down. It's up again. All right, and your posture.
Oh, oh my God, are you crazy? What are you doing?
Stop screaming. I'm teaching you to act like a man. All right. All right. Now, this is a dinner party. Let's work with food.
Now, from what I understand, originally, Robin Williams was to play your role. Steve Martin was to play Armand. And then Steve Martin dropped out, and Robin Williams said he would play Armand, and then you were asked to play opposite him.
Right. Yes. Steve had another commitment, couldn't do it. Robin decided after Mrs. Doubtfire, he didn't want to get an address again. And then that role opened up, and somehow my name came up, and I did a screen test. At first, I wasn't going to be able to do it. I had to turn it down because I was committed to doing a revival of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum with Scott Rudin.
Playgoers, I bid you welcome. The theater is a temple, and we are here to worship the gods of comedy and tragedy. Tonight, I am pleased to announce a comedy. We shall employ every device we know in our desire to divert you.
And then, they had been building this show around me, and it was going to be a conflict with that, and so I had to turn the part down, and then I would occasionally get a call from Mike Nichols saying, I'm seeing other people, and I just keep thinking you're the person to do this role. And I said, oh well, Mr. Nichols, I would love to do it, but I said I don't have any power. I said, but you're Mike Nichols. Perhaps if you called Scott Rudin, he might consider postponing or rearranging dates. And so Mike said, yes. And then the next day, there was a call from Scott Rudin asking me, do you really want to do this? And I said, yes, I'd love to do it if it could work out. And so he postponed A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And I went off and did The Birdcage. And it wound up helping Forum, because by the time we opened Forum, The Birdcage had been out, and it certainly had raised my visibility on a national level, and so people were aware of that, and I think it helped. It helped the show, but it was a very fortunate thing that Scott allowed me to do it.
I'll be soulless, the man, if I could only be free.
Sing it,
free.
Spell it.
F-R-E-E. No, the long way.
F-R-E-E.
Free.
How much of the decision, because so much of your work has been on stage, most recently, as I mentioned, in The Front Page and soon to be Angels in America, how much of that decision to dedicate the career to the theater versus, because of the great success of The Birdcage, I assume you were offered many roles. Is that the truth? And if so, or was it your decision that this is where you wanted to be and spend your time?
No, I wasn't offered many roles, to be honest. That didn't happen. I thought perhaps it might happen, and I had hoped that it would open up my film career, but it did not. Honestly, what I remember happened is I was offered two movies. One was Mr. Magoo. They were going to do Mr. Magoo as a film.
Yeah.
And they said to me, and I met with his, he was an Asian director. He didn't speak a lot of English, and he So he explained to me that, I said, well, what are you going to, you know, I said, I remember the cartoon. I remember Jim Backus.
Yeah.
And I said, is that what you want? You know, would I, you know, shave my head and squint and bump into things? And he said, by George. And, you know, there's a lot of that. And he said, no, we're not going to do any of that. He said, none of that. No, no, I don't want to do that. And I said, well, then what is it? Then he's just a guy. I mean, if he's not nearsighted and a bumbling old gentleman, I said, I don't know what the character is. Anyway, I turned that down, and then the other film that I was offered was DreamWorks. It was just starting, and they were doing this film with a guy named Gore Verbinski, whose big claim to fame at the time was that he had directed the Budweiser Frog commercial.
Oh, right, sure.
And I met with him. It was a movie called Mouse Hunt, and he said, you know, he had this very dark vision for what I'm sure DreamWorks was imagining was going to be a very contemporary family film, sort of a Tom and Jerry cartoon come to life with these two brothers trying to get rid of a mouse. But I kept saying, I just don't, it's just 2 hours of us chasing a mouse. And he said, yeah, but I see this as, bringing up Roman Polanski's The Tenant. And I would say, yeah, but we're making a movie called Mouse Hunt. So he did say that he was interested in this British comedian, Lee Evans, who I had seen in a movie called Funny Bones, and I thought he was just brilliant. And I thought, well, that's an interesting combination. And then the way he was talking, it sounded like it was going to be very subversive, this whatever this film was going to be. And of course, he wound up making it, you know, the DreamWorks, you know, hated what he was doing. You know, it was all done. It looked like a period piece. It was like a Coen Brothers movie for children. It was very odd. But they got Christopher Walken and what's his name, the great character actor. It was his last film, William Hickey, played our father.
Sure.
And and now people, other than the Birdcage, this is the film that people mention to me. It's usually people of a certain age who are children at the time who were taken to it and were traumatized. Or Russian cab drivers love Mouse Hunt. It's the first thing they say to me when I get in a cab. They say, you're in Mouse Movie. The Mouse Movie is the greatest film ever made. Those are the two offers. So
yeah.
I went with the one where I thought the director and the other actor, you know, were great, and I thought it had some potential, but the kinds of roles that I hope might come my way didn't. I certainly, my first love has always been the theater, and if more interesting film roles had materialized, I certainly would have done that. But I, you know, I've always returned to the theater, and I've always felt that I think it's where you learn the most. Certainly as a young actor, that's how I felt. I will always learn more by working in the theater. And certainly as you get older, you know, it's where the most interesting roles are. I mean, now, of course, television is opening up, and you know, some of the best writing happening is in television now, because movies have become all about superhero films.
Right.
Or special effects films, and it's less and less. There's small independent films, but it's, you know, it's often hard to make a living doing that. So television has been a great, place to go and find great writing as well as the theater.
I realized today as I was looking at a list of your Broadway credits that I've seen every show that you've been in since Present Laughter, with the exception, and I feel horrible about this, with the exception of Doug Henning's Merlin.
Oh.
What did I miss?
You didn't miss a thing. that was a terrible show, but I got to work with Cheetah Rivera. I could do an hour on Merlin. There's a lot of Merlin material. But, you know, it was one of those moments where I was offered a role in a new musical starring Cheetah Rivera, and it seemed like it was going to be fun.
And who knew, right?
And then it wasn't so much fun, but it was an experience I'll never forget. Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned, Nathan Lane will be live on stage at Proctor's Theater on Friday night for an evening of conversation and Q&A following a showing of The Birdcage. You can find out more by going to proctors.org. Also, he will reprise his West End role as Roy Cohn in Tony Kushner's Angels in America beginning February at the Neil Simon Theater on Broadway. Nathan Lane, a great pleasure to speak with you. What a delight. Thank you very much.
Staying here. Thank you so much, Joe. I appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, you can find out more information about Nathan Lane at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady on Friday night at 7:30. Following a showing of The Birdcage and a Q&A, proctors.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.